to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And the Committee of Legislative Assistance has taken the roll. We do have a quorum. May I have a motion to approve the minutes from March 22nd meeting?
Mr. Chair, I would make that motion.
Reverend Poston moves to approve the March 22nd minutes. Are there any discussions? Any corrections? Any discussions? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The March 22 minutes have been approved. Well, I'd just like to welcome everybody that's here and just to maybe share an experience I had this last weekend. As we know, March 29th is dedicated as the Vietnam War Day here in Minnesota and also across the nation. And every year up in Forest Lake, I belong to the VFW American Legions up there, and our American Legion hosts a Vietnam War Day. We had veterans from all over the state, Vietnam War veterans from all over the state that came in. It was standing room only in a big auditorium that our American Legion. And every year we also bring in Vietnam War veterans as guest speakers. And this year we brought in three tunnel rats. You probably never heard of the word tunnel rats before, but these are usually small in stature, but big in courage and big in heart. These three gentlemen answered various questions from the MC and talked about their experiences in Vietnam with the as being a tunnel rat, going through these tunnels, and their experiences there. It's just unbelievable. And it was really neat to meet them and talk with them and chat with them and visit with all the different Vietnam vets that came in, the men and women. In fact, the year before, we had three nurses that came in that served during the Vietnam War, told their stories. So, outstanding. Anyway, first thing on the agenda, all the bills that we've come forward through this committee, we've gotten out the door. They're all in different committees and so forth. So we've done our job, committee members, as a division. And our first, so what I thought we'd do is bring in some of the different agencies, talk about what they're doing, some maybe things that they are looking at in the future, and talk about, what's happened with maybe some of the funds that we were able to provide some of these different agencies, and then go from there. So the first thing on our agenda, if you look at your agenda, is a presentation from the Minnesota Historical Society of Fort Snelling proposal. And I've heard your presentation a few times now. I'll probably hear it again in another committee. But welcome to the Historical Society, to the House Veterans Affairs Division. And please introduce yourselves to the committee, and we'll go ahead and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stephen Elliott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present the Minnesota Historical Society's top priority for the 2018 capital budget, Historic Fort Snelling. I will be brief to share our time with three distinguished testifiers. Mr. Chair, we appreciate your taking the time this past fall to visit Historic Fort Snelling. Members of the committee, we would welcome the opportunity to take you on a tour of this significant historic place. It's extremely helpful to see Fort Snelling in person, to appreciate both the historic landscape and structures where so much of our state's history happened, and to see the pressing facility needs at Minnesota's first national historic landmark. This is a place where two major rivers meet, the Dote, where people have gathered for millennia, where cultures have met for generations, and it is the home of Minnesota's oldest building, the Round Tower, and its oldest residence, the Commandant's House. And I'd like to be very clear that our plans for Historic Fort Snelling include continuing and expanding our presentation of military history. This is an historic fort, and military history plays central role. We have an opportunity to tell additional stories, including expanding the military themes, that Minnesotans and visitors from beyond our state have not had an opportunity to experience. Adaptive reuse of historic buildings offering improved visitor facilities is needed to improve the visitor experience. Our vision for the site is to create a destination for discovery, learning, healing, and a place of community connection, and to engage visitors in a much broader range of history stories, beginning much earlier and extending the story of the fort and the hundreds of thousands who served there, who went through the fort into the mid-20th century. Funding for this site will create a new visitor center and preserve historic structures. We will develop programs that will engage visitors in the many stories that have happened at this important place. Mr. Chair, on your visit, you had an opportunity to visit the current underground visitor center, a modern facility, and here are a few images of the chronic water penetration and serious and costly maintenance challenges of that building. We're very appreciative of funding provided in the 2017 capital budget bill for design for this project and an earlier appropriation for pre-design in 2015. We've recently completed schematic design and we're excited to share some of the early ideas. Visitor services will be located in two historic structures called Buildings 18 and 21 and will improve the visual connection to the Mississippi River. These floor plans give you a sense of the visitor functions that will go into these buildings. Building 22, an 1878 munitions building, will welcome visitors and orient them to the area, the larger area. And it will provide much needed space for school groups because we're maxed out on that space right now. Building 18, a 1904 cavalry barracks, will serve as the visitor center, including 4,500 square feet of exhibit space on the first floor, more than doubling our current exhibit capacity. And on the second floor, we'll have more space to accommodate school groups, programs, and meetings. The state of Minnesota has made commitments for this project through two appropriations for pre-design and design. Our request this year is for construction. Well, typically, the state has responsibility for historic sites in the statutorily designated historic sites network. In this case, we know that Fort Snelling is important to many, many Minnesotans, and we've committed to raising funds to supplement the construction appropriation that we hope the state will provide. Construction of Fort Snelling began in the fall of 1820. We're approaching a bicentennial, not a centennial, not a sesquicentennial, but a bicentennial in Minnesota of this site, designated a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. We ask that you approve the fort's construction appropriation this session to keep the Fort Snelling project on track for Fort Snelling's 200th birthday. And now, Mr. Chair, if I may, I would like to introduce General Rick Nash, Professor Annette. Oh, we have a video, short video, 2 minutes, and then a couple minutes.
Before Minnesota became Minnesota, there was a place, a confluence of two great rivers, where cultures and civilizations crossed for thousands of years, where something new was imagined. A remote American outpost built, a place of pride and sorrow.
It's a place of rebirth and birth, but it's also a place of great tragedy.
Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first national historic landmark. In 2020, Fort Snelling will be 200 years old. In time for its bicentennial, we have a new, expanded vision for the site, where visitors connect with each other, with the many stories that bind us together, with the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. Our plan includes a new visitor center to replace inadequate and aging facilities, places for private reflection and public remembrance, a reimagined visitor experience sharing more complete stories of the diverse people who shaped our state and country.
Did you find it surprising that we did actually have slaves here at Fort Snelling?
Stories of the many soldiers who prepared here to fight for America. Soldiers who are buried nearby. With new investment, historic Fort Snelling will attract more of the millions who pass through this busy corridor every year. By sharing an American story told nowhere else. With its bicentennial on the horizon, help us realize the potential of this unique place and position historic Fort Snelling for the next century and beyond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I may introduce three other testifiers who will speak very briefly, General Rick Nash, Professor Annette Atkins, and Dr. Karen Lucas, and then we'd be pleased to respond to questions.
Dr. Lash.
If I could, thanks, Mr. Chair, before the other testifiers come up, I was wondering, could you tell me one of the most significant things that I've asked about over the years is Fort Snelling's role in the Dred Scott versus Sanford case, and as I understand it, we don't quite know where those barracks were or where the location was. Is that still true?
Mr. Elliott?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that excellent question. Dred and Harriet Scott came to Fort Snelling separately, but they met, fell in love, and were married at Fort Snelling. Dred's owner was a physician at the fort. And so we have identified a living quarters which we believe is the probable location where they live, supporting the doctor who lived upstairs in the medical wing. There's no ironclad documentation for it. This is, you know, based on an understanding of the buildings and of how spaces were assigned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's one. Is that one of the buildings we still need to renovate, that space?
Mr. Elliott?
Mr. Chair, no, that building is in pretty good shape. That's not one of the buildings included in this project.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. And, Mr. Chair, just while the other testifiers are coming forward, just by way of a statement, that to me is one of the most significant roles in Minnesota history, Minnesota's role in that case, whereby Dred Scott sued for his freedom on the basis of his location in free territory by here in Minnesota, something we should be very, very proud of. And I hope we can do whatever we can to encourage that as a tourist attraction and for student groups as well. I think it's something that we as Minnesotans should be proud of, and it's very significant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Just to add on to Representative Lesh's question, one of the things that we've been doing is working with Lynn Jackson, who is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott. She's founded a foundation in St. Louis to help tell the story of Dred and Harriet Scott. She's been to Minnesota a number of times, and if you look in your folder, there's an opinion piece that she wrote for MinnPost telling that story and explaining why this is an important place. You've got a white folder on the left side, has a opinion piece from Lynn Jackson that I think you'll find interesting.
I would look at it. Mr. Lash, I could just qualify my statements too, and thinking back about what saying about Minnesota should be proud of. Minnesota should not be proud of the decision. That was one of the most backward decisions in the history of the Republic. However, Minnesotans' role in it was very important. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rev. Lash. General? Who's going to be speaking first? Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Karen Tanaka Lucas. I'm a resident of Apple Valley, and I represent the Twin Cities Japanese American Citizens League.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. My family has been an American one for well over a century, and I have been a Minnesotan for almost 50 years. I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota Medical School. My dad was a U.S. military soldier who retired as a major after 20 years of service to our country. He was born and raised in California. He was drafted in June of 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor. He was trained in infantry heavy weapons. And when the Army recognized the dire need of language intelligence services in World War II, they tested their 4,000 or so Japanese-American soldiers and found that 90% of these guys could not speak Japanese. They were born and raised in this country, and there were only 10% who had useful language skills to be used by the military. These 10%, even amongst this 10%, most of them needed intensive language training. My dad was in the first class of mostly Japanese-American soldiers who was intensively trained in 1942 with the then top-secret military intelligence language service in Camp Savage, Minnesota. This was part of the first ever military language intelligence program in the country. And it was housed in Minnesota during World War II because of the receptiveness of Governor Stassen and the people of Minnesota after more than a dozen other states had turned it down. It was moved to Fort Snelling when it outgrew the rudimentary Camp Savage facilities and ended up training 6,000 Japanese-American soldiers and language intelligence for World War II. My dad, and for the post-war occupation of Japan. My dad served in the South Pacific and interrogated, captured prisoners of war, even as his entire family was incarcerated along with 120,000 other Americans of Japanese descent for over 3 years in what was then called internment camps. The military intelligence service soldiers trained at Fort Snelling have been credited with shortening the war in the Pacific by 2 years. After the war, Dad served 8 years in the occupation of Japan, along with other Fort Snelling-trained linguists, and they helped in the disarming of the Japanese military and the war crimes trials, and eventually my dad worked in counterintelligence. The Japanese American Citizens League would like to thank the Minnesota Historical Society and Historic Fort Snelling, who have been working with us over the last 3 years in presenting programs highlighting the unique role of Minnesota in American history. Visitors come from all over the country to see these exhibits, and in fact, our guest registries indicate that they come from all over the world. And we found that the facilities, exhibit facilities, to be suboptimal for these exhibits. So the Japanese American Citizens League of the Twin Cities asks for your support for the funding of the revitalization of historic Fort Snelling.
Thank you. Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Major General Retired Rick Nash, and I'm in front of you today as a volunteer board member of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I also sit as a member of its executive council. Today, I'm here to seek your support for the Fort Snelling Visitor Center request and to thank you as members of the legislature for your previous appropriations for the initial design funds. As a member, as a former commissioner of the Department of Military Affairs and your adjutant general of the state of Minnesota, I will speak to the importance of this project for our soldiers, our airmen, our veterans, and their families. As many of you know, our current history at Fort Snelling dates back to the 5th Regiment of the United States Infantry, which arrived in 1819. And we trace our lineage and our heritage for that period of time through the famous 1st Minnesota Regiment to our current Minnesota Army National Guard. We continue to use Fort Snelling today for our departure ceremonies, for promotions, for yellow ribbon proclamations to companies across Minnesota, as well as staff as a staff training venue for our soldiers and our airmen. Our nearly 14,000 men and women of your National Guard value this historic piece of land. There are currently our Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force units assigned to facilities on the greater complex of Fort Snelling. And a new venue will certainly add additional capacity to tell more veterans' stories through our current conflicts that will include our active Guard and Reserve members and their families. And it's not only a place for where civilians, students, and their veterans and their families gather to learn and to study military history, but it also provides a venue to understand our pre-Fort Snelling history that needs to be researched and fully understood as we continue to unearth our Native American history and culture. Their stories certainly need to be documented, preserved, and presented to our state. As in an emerging and diverse state that values inclusion, we need a new venue. And by repurposing the old cavalry barracks as a value-based alternative, we can, going forward, fully explore our Japanese-American history, our African-American history, Anglo-Saxon, early European ancestry, their cultures and histories which impacted and shaped the true gateway to Minnesota prior to statehood. An additional area that must be researched and told is also the less documented and the negative aspects of the fort. And that is the fact that slavery was a part of the fort's life early in its history. The new center must be a gathering place for all Minnesotans that will present our past, our present, and provide for the future, which in my opinion, it is not now being fully utilized nor welcoming. We need to value it as a destination in Minnesota where all visitors are provided an opportunity to learn in a conducive environment, to better understand who we are today and why we value and can learn from where Minnesota actually started. I urge the committee to look favorably on this request. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, General. And we got Annette.
Here, yes. Annette Atkins. I'm Professor Emeritus of History from St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict. I'm also involved in the private fundraising for the revitalization of Fort Snelling. And thank you for welcoming us back. And I'm going to lean up because I can't quite see. Are you John Lesh?
Is that John Lesh.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I want to talk about Dred Scott, but Dred Scott and the Korematsu decision both have important roots and connections to Fort Snelling. So the direction that you're going, I think, really helps me make my point, which is that Fort Snelling as an exhibit space has been frozen in 1820. And there are so many other important stories to layer over the top of that, that we have a sense of the fort as a vital and alive and living, changing place over time is part of what this revitalization is about. That so many stories intersect there. I think of Franklin Steele, sort of early businessman, Henry Sibley, Alexander Ramsey, all of those guys. But then there are the kind of, as we would have said then in the 19th century, sort of their mixed blood families, Indian families, Native American families, up through the grandmother of one of my friends who was a servant for one of the soldiers at Fort Snelling in the 1940s. So that story spread so far. And to make it clear, we're not making changes at the fort. We're making changes in the visitor center. The visitor center is a 1970s building that, as Steve's slides showed, is falling apart. And so I see turning those barracks into part of expanding and telling that story in a more vital way. So we don't just have the barracks in the old fort, we have the barracks that are 100 some years later. That the fort is so important, and at one hearing where we talked, one person suggests that the Capitol is one of our signature places and Fort Snelling should be another of our signature places. Those are where most people in Minnesota go to learn our history. And they are both living, breathing institutions, organizations, and markers. And as we know, thousands of school children go every year to Fort Snelling. And I think right now, we don't tell a rich enough story to them. If we want to learn from the past, we have to make sure that we know more of it. And right now, the fort could help us tell so much richer, more vibrant story. And I'm sorry our fourth testifier can't be here with us today. She is a member of the Dakota community. And so it's very important that you know that we have very strong involvement and support from the Dakota community for doing this as well, so that they're suggesting and teaching us that that site has been a sacred, important, holy site for longer than we even knew or remembered. So part of this revitalization is saying, what an important story we have to tell here, and we'd like the facilities in which we could tell it better. So as a scholar, as a participant in this Minnesota story, I too urge that we fund this revitalization, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Any questions from the committee? I have a personal story. Well, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Elliott, if he's still here. Mr. Elliott, is anything going to be happening to the chapel?
Mr. Chair, sir, not as a part of this project. The chapel is administered by the Department of Natural Resources. And, of course, we work with them on things, but there is no work at the chapel that's included in this project scope. So. Yeah.
The chapel is near and dear to my heart. My parents were married there. My parents' funerals were both there, and I had a sister that had a funeral there, and they all have been laid to rest at the National Cemetery. Yeah. So thanks for taking such good care of it.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Yeah. Just for the committee, that personal story, during my 25 years serving in uniform, two of those years I had a command. And you might ask yourself, well, what does a one officer command? Well, at that time,
A committee.
But at the time, during the Clinton years, the military intelligence units in the Midwest were taken away. So I was looking for a home. And at the time, with the 88th Regional Support Command, General Steiner asked me if I would like to be a commander. And I said, well, what will I command, sir? He says, you're going to command my 451st Army Band. So for 2 years, I was commander of the band. No music background. In junior high, I took, you know. But anyway, I ended up having to actually do some conducting of the band. But getting back to Fort Snelling, it was the 4th of July. Our band had a concert right there at the command, right in front of the commander's house there, right in the square there. And we set up a stage, and we had a 41 member band there, and we were put on a music concert for 4th of July. And then when it got dark, we had some people down below on the cliff that was fireworks were went up above the Fort Snelling. It was just a beautiful display. It was a beautiful night. During John Flasusu, Stars and Stripes Forever, and we coordinated the music with the fireworks, and so that was my neat experience with Fort Snelling. It was just a neat experience. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate the opportunity, and we do have a fife and drum corps, so if you ever want to, you know, bring current your musical expertise and leadership.
My job with the band was to find somebody within the band to go to one officer candidate school, which I did. And after 2 years, then I went back into the military intelligence area. And the linguists, during my time in the military, we sent all of our linguists out to Monterey, California, where they, during my time, it was mostly Russian and Chinese, and but we had to work with. So thank you. Thank you for coming. Next, we have a presentation on the dedication of the new Building 22 of the Minneapolis Veterans Home. And the dedication took place last Thursday, March 22nd. And I had the opportunity, I got excused out of one of my committees that I served on to attend that dedication. And it was just a great presentation. And I know after the dedication, I asked Ben Johnson to come in and show, a 6-minute video that you showed there. I think you're also working on a 40-minute video. And Mr. Hunter, you did a great welcoming of the people there, and also with, I think it was Mr. Tom Paul.
Yes, he's...
Mr. Tom Paul, who's a good friend of mine. I've known him for many years. He lives in Forest Lake. So, but welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Detmer, members of the committee. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. With the dedication of Building 22, we marked another great milestone at the rich 130-year history of that campus and its service to veterans. Initial funding for the construction was in 2008, an omnibus capital investment bill, about $9 million, so 35% contribution from the state to get in line for federal funds. For the 91 residents who call current Building 6 their home, it's an opportunity for MDVA and the Minneapolis campus to showcase a new state-of-the-art facility that will provide countless new amenities, not the least of which will be the privacy of their own accommodations. Building 17 North and South was demolished also with assistance from the Minnesota legislature. And the move to Building 22 completes a comprehensive multi-year planning and construction program involving hundreds of dedicated staff whose task it was to design and build these beautiful buildings with one goal in mind, and that was to provide our veterans with the accommodations, privacy that they need and deserve. With me today is Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare Division, Douglas Hughes. Deputy Commissioner Hughes joined MDVA in June of 2016. His leadership experience encompasses a variety of sectors, including military, business, and healthcare. He's retired Army, having served with the Army Special Forces for the majority of his career. 2001, he joined 3M as an advanced regulatory associate in the pharmaceutical division, ultimately moving up to the position of regional business manager for their Latin American pharmaceutical division. Prior to joining MDVA, he worked at the Minneapolis VA healthcare system, overseeing more than 60 private nursing homes and 100 private home care agency. He holds a bachelor's degree in both nursing and Spanish and a master's in business. Deputy
Hughes, welcome.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Douglas Hughes, Deputy Commissioner for Healthcare, MDVA. There's been a lot of changes over on the Minneapolis campus and throughout the entire state. We've really done a lot to bring great leadership to the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. We really have fantastic leaders in pretty much every one of our locations. So Building 22 is only one change that we've had recently. We've had a lot of change, and as you mentioned, your neighbor Tom Paul, who's been in long-term care for decades, he said to me the other week that he's never seen so much change in the time that he's been there. And he's only been there for about 14 months, and all of it was for the good. We recently will begin construction on a permanent fixed dental clinic at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. It will be, we believe, the first dental clinic, fixed facility dental clinic, in a state veterans home in the country. We received funding from various agencies, DAV, V for V, and Delta Dental, which was very generous with a $100,000 donation. We also plan on having fixed dental clinics in the other three skilled facilities around the state. This last year, we also launched a partnership with the St. Catharines University, where we have a variety of healthcare disciplines that use our site for clinical for their clinical site. We plan on expanding with St. Catharines University. We are always looking for more partners. We just had another lead this morning with the University of St. Thomas, and we're also looking to expand with other educational institutions throughout the state with our other facilities. Soon, all of our facilities will be Center for Medicare and Medicaid certified, which is quite an accomplishment. It shows that we have risen to that level, which we're very proud of. So I'd like to talk a little bit just briefly about our guest speaker that we had at the dedication. Her name is Kay Bauer. To put it in one word, she was a hoot. She really gave a fantastic speech. I don't think there was one person who did not pay attention to every single word that she said. She was a Navy nurse in Vietnam. She was not on a ship, but she was rather on the ground with a small surgical team in Vietnam. And she told a great story of her time in Vietnam and then some of the things that happened to her after in Minnesota when her office was bombed those sort of things when she came back from Vietnam. So in a moment, I'd like to show you a video of our staff and all that they do. Last week's ceremony, as Ben mentioned, was a very long journey that we had with our upgrade of our facilities. What you're going to see is that our facility now, we have private rooms and private bathrooms for all of our residents. We have gardens, we have balconies, we have putting green. Now we're going to be very careful about kind of the instruments that they use out in there in the putting green, but we'll be safe on that. But we're very fortunate in that several months ago, Twin Cities Public TV wanted to do a documentary on our rich history. There's going to be a 30-minute video that's going to show sometime around the beginning of summer, but here's a 6-minute video that we'd like to show everyone. Is that the sound?
I have audio here, but not in front of you guys.
Do you have the auxiliary cord plugged in?
Stick the mic on the computer.
Back then, soldiers who had fought in the Civil War really didn't have any sort of a safety net for their health care or place to go. And so Minnesota, along with many other states, established soldiers' homes to take care of them for the rest of their life. The soldiers who fought in the Civil War really needed some place to go for physical healing or mental healing, and do it with comrades who actually had fought in battles so that they were able to share common experiences.
The feeling of camaraderie veterans sought over 100 years ago is still shared by today's residents.
One of the first questions they'll ask each other is, what branch are you in? And they catch you off guard with a story about their service or their past or their family, and you really get to, you know, speak with them and make that connection. And the luxury of my job is I get to spend that time with them. You know, that is my job, to be able to be with them and be present and experience those moments together with them.
I just, like, if I can see you guys smile, then I feel like I've done my job.
But to hear their stories is really something. A lot of these guys got some stories to tell.
I earned my wings as a bombardier navigator. After I got my wings, they made me come back and be an instructor.
I bought the Johns Hopkins from the graduate school. I'd done well in high school, and then I went on to Johns Hopkins. I got accepted for medical school. And then I ended up in the war.
Yeah, three students that came every morning and afternoon. We started them on stilts, and you'd have to have the bomb site get that bug. That's how you started.
My MOS was a pediatrician, but our main duty was to take care of the wounded that came through. You know, that was a shocker for me, you know. Yeah, I mean, you get blown up in Vietnam and you're a mess.
He really enjoys writing when he's here. When I drive him here, he has his magazine and then the papers for the writing that he works on. They understand who Ron is. Ron found a chair that he is comfortable in for writing. They let him be. They don't push, but they encourage him to be who he is while he's here. It's a place that he feels at home and cared about, that he's part of. It's a deeper sense of belonging. The longevity of staff is very unique. So for us, that's a significant strength. What it does for our residents is it provides them the opportunity to really have person-centered care.
And what if we go down to the day room?
It's somebody that really knows them, knows their routine, and I think that that provides then our families great comfort in having staff that really are dedicated to being here and dedicated to knowing the residents. I think the veteran stories are really what brings most of our staff here, and I think those especially that are here for a long time really find a greater purpose than what they might find in any other healthcare setting.
This is the longest I've worked in any home. And I get to know their families, so I get to know the families pretty good too. When they come, they get able to ask me a question I'm able to answer, so it kind of gives them relief that their loved ones are getting taken care of. Quiet, huh?
Let's see what else is going on in the world today.
The activities are so good here. One morning she brings a newspaper and they call it Coffee and News, and she reads the current events that was in the newspaper, and that's interesting.
So the Vikings are trying to pick a quarterback. Who will they go with next season? What do you think? Tarkenton, bring him back. Bring back Grant Tarkenton. That's a wild card choice.
The staff take great pride in being able to take care of our nation's heroes. This has been the case since the earliest days of the soldier's home.
We have some buildings that have been around since the late 1880s. Building 10 is the original old soldier's home. In addition to that, we have other buildings that were built slightly after that that were still preserved and are modernized for today. Building 22 is a very large building. It'll have 100 individual rooms, but what it also does, it provides spaces in there for families, for friends, that they can just gather so that they're not just in their room all the time.
Building 22 has a lot more space for the guys and a lot more homey of a feel than we have right now. And the guys are really looking forward to having more areas to gather, maybe some more quiet areas as well, you know, different places to kind of find a spot.
Having your own room is going to be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've talked about that for quite a while.
I'm looking forward to the move. Might be this month, they tell me.
Yep. It's going to be this month.
It's an honor to have them here. We have a beautiful space here for veterans. We want people to know that they can share our beautiful space here that we have. Our mission is to take care of our residents who are heroes in our eyes and should be heroes in the eyes of everyone in our country.
Very good.
So as you can see, we did the ribbon cutting on building 22, as you noted last Thursday. Next step will be a transition of our residents from building 6 into the new building 22. For those who weren't able to make it, most in this room had a lot going on last week as it was the first deadline. But please feel free to reach out to me, Deputy Commissioner Hughes, the Senior Director, Simone Hogan. If you'd like to come and visit the home and see the new building, we're very proud of it. It is the third new building on campus. It's been a long process, but we're very proud of it and excited to get our residents moved over. Chair, any other questions for you?
Any questions from the committee? I don't see any, but again, thank you. And we'll be looking forward to that 30-minute video that comes out. So well done. Well done. Thank you. Our next two presentations on this. On the state of Minnesota efforts to recruit and retain veterans employment. And first, Deputy Commissioner Ed Hudson from the Minnesota Management and Budget will talk about efforts to recruit veterans to state jobs. And then I'll have Mr. Finley come up, Jim Finley from the Department of Employment and Economic Development will talk about the state veterans hiring program. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself. for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Edwin Hudson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Enterprise Human Capital at MMB, working for Meyer in France. I'm also honored to say that I've served as a non-commissioned officer in the United States Army as well as the Air Force Reserves. On behalf of MMB, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to come to address the committee today, and I'd like to provide you with a brief update on the state's efforts as it relates to our recruiting and retention of veterans. Over 353,000 veterans and service members call the state of Minnesota their home. While serving in our armed forces, these brave men and women serve the betterment of our country ahead of their own interests, their own well-being. It's because of their selflessness that we enjoy the principles of freedoms and liberty that the United States was founded upon. I know there are members and veterans here and serve in this current body, the Minnesota Legislature. I would like to take a moment just to offer my sincere gratitude to each of you for your service, and like to also recognize that your continued service here in this capacity is greatly appreciated. Thank you. At the state, we are honored to have nearly 3,000 veterans and service members in our workforce. Veterans are invaluable. They have an invaluable set of skill sets they learn during their services. And we are proud to be able to offer them opportunities to come to work for us here in the state. From the demonstrated leadership, teamwork skills, and the ability to work well under pressure and triumph over adversity, the expertise of these men and women bring to the state is instrumental in the work we do today. Since taking office, Governor Mark Dayton has consistently supported veterans and members of military families. He has worked especially hard to encourage employers, including the state government, to hire veterans. From proclaiming July as the Veteran Month, to attending Minnesota Veterans Career Fairs, to promoting programs like Police Academy specifically for veterans, Governor Dayton is an immutable advocate for veterans. In 2015, Governor Dayton established Diversity and Inclusion Council to improve the recruiting and retention of our state employees from a diverse background and improve contracting processes for business owned by Minnesotans from diverse backgrounds and promotes civic engagement in the state. Governor Dayton and the Diversity and Inclusion Council recognized the skills and expertise veterans bring to the workplace, and the administration has been actively engaged in recruiting and hiring more veterans. Since we first established the goal in 2015 of increasing veteran representation in our workplace, our message has been very, very clear. We want to hire veterans because of their skills, their expertise, and their work ethics. We, as a large employer, need to hire veterans. The market is very competitive right now. We have what we call negative employment with a 3.1% unemployment rate here in the state. And if you look at the workforce that's available, we need veterans even more so. We want to tap into this resource. Today, I'm happy to report that 8.3% of the state government full-time employees in the cabinet-level agencies self-identify as veterans. So as of today, and again, this is voluntary information that veterans can give us. Sometimes they self-disclose, sometimes they don't. But currently, 8.3% of our workforce make up of veterans. Now, for comparison, the statewide workforce is made of 5.1% of veterans according to the 2016 census. Okay, that just gives you comparison there. So we're ahead of the game. Last year, almost 9% of veterans were hired across all state agencies. I had some numbers that I'd like to share with you that I didn't have in my talking points. I'll just go off script here just a little bit just to share with you. Of the 13,622 applicants that we had in FY17, 4,093 of them were veterans. Again, we had 13,620 plus applicants, individuals applying to come to work for the state, and of them we had 4,093 of them who were veterans. And of that same reporting period, FY17, we have 538 veterans who were hired over that same reporting period. Last year, again, we talked about what our rates was. I'd just kind of like to go back in 2015. We had 314 hires, which was about 7.5% of the workforce. 16, we had 377 hires, which again was about 7. It was 6.7% of the workforce. And in 2017, we had 412 or 7.5% hires. So we're up this year at 8.3, but prior to that, for the last 3 years, we hovered around 7%. So we're pleased with that. Even though our number currently is 8.3%, that's of the executive branches. So if you look at all of our commission, all of our commissions, plans, and all of our agencies, that number is a slight uptick to about 10% of our workforce is comprised of veterans. Our success in recruiting veterans can be attributed to the work at MMB and our executive branch agencies. We're very proud of our agencies and the work that they've done there. Now, we've had a lot of job fairs and a lot of other veterans activities that we've worked in partnership, and we're very, again, pleased with their work. Certain veterans with disabilities can be appointed to classified positions on non-competitive basis if they meet qualifying factors. Last year, for the first time, we had a statewide campaign to acknowledge and to support our veterans. So we recognized them and we presented them with challenge coins, all of our veterans, and this was a success. And what it did for us, we found out that this was an event that really it was internal branding and external branding. From an external perspective, it gave us the opportunity to tell veterans that this is the place we welcome you to come and work. We want to be the employer of choice for our veterans. Internally, we had some veterans who had not declared that they were veterans, so this gave us the opportunity for them to say, hey, you know, I'd like to go into self-service, and I'd like to declare that I, too, am a veteran. So we started to see the numbers to tick up. So we were pleased that, now we know that some veterans still have not declared for whatever reason, but we hope someday that they will come around and declare and get the recognition that they deserve. Again, realizing that the veteran data is voluntarily reported, this was an event, again, that was very critical for them to come out and to self-identify through the employee portal, the self-service portal. I'd like to just take a few minutes just to highlight some of the activities that's taking place out in the agencies. First, I'd like to mention that Major General Jensen, I saw General here just a few minutes ago, but we've been partnering with Military Affairs and also with the staff over at Veterans Affairs, and now General Clyburn at Minute. We've already had some conversations with her, drawing on her expertise on how we might better serve our veteran community. So we have the Department of Natural Resources, DNR. They're one of our first yellow ribbon agencies, and so we're very pleased with their work. They have a 5-year strategic plan with what they're trying to do for veterans, and they also will likely have a career fair for, dedicated for veterans coming up in the fall. There are other agencies such as DHS, who's been working with our veterans. We have the Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED. You'll hear from them here in a little bit. They're going to tell you about their work. But also at DHS and at MnDOT, we have what we call ERGs, which are Employment Resource Groups. Now, we typically have them for different race and ethnicity groups, but we're pleased that we have them for even our veterans group. I was looking at your video when you were talking about the vets home. This ERG is kind of a group where veterans can come and trade stories and just kind of talk about things and also talk about things that will help them in the workforce, things that they can do that empower them and to navigate some of the things here in the state. So we're pleased that we have an employee resource group for them. So in conclusion, Chair Debman and members of the Veterans Affairs, we're very proud of the success and the increasing representation in the workforce. We hope very soon that not only we have a few agencies who are yellow ribbon, but as a state, we hope to become a statewide company. That would be pretty neat to have the entire state, not just four or five agencies, but the state of Minnesota to become a yellow ribbon company. So we're very pleased, and we have a lot more work that's planned, but with that, I'll just pause and see if you have any questions of us.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from the committee? One thing for the committee, I know, Representative Lewick, you've got a bill on the General Register for the that might state that would the Secretary of State, when they ask for different positions, the different committees or appointments, that now there's a form when you want to apply, you can actually check that you are a veteran, and that wasn't part of it before. So thank you for carrying that bill, and it's on the General Register too. Hopefully you'll get on the House floor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, it's kind of peculiar that we had a whole big chunk in the middle of that application form for an appointment, and there's well over 200 positions within the state agencies that either there'd be a governor's appointment or a agency commissioner's appointment, and we'd ask all kinds of other things we could voluntarily disclose. We didn't have a block on there to self-identify as a veteran, so the Secretary of State's help, once we get that to the governor's desk, we'll add that little block.
And Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understood the testifier correctly, Mr. Hudson, that you said the state of Minnesota is not a yellow ribbon organization right now, and what would we need to still do to get that designation?
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your question. We really appreciate that, Representative. We believe the criterion to become a yellow ribbon state, we believe we're doing much of that. In fact, maybe 90-plus percent of that we're already doing. It's just a matter of completing the application. We hope to do that as a state versus the three or four agencies who have gone forth with that process. So we hope to have that designation here fairly quickly. General Clyburn has been already after me and after our team about going in that direction. So we're pleased to have the encouragement from General Clyburn to pick up this designation. There's one thing, Mr. Chair, if I may go back, I was remiss in mentioning the Department of Admin's work, their Office of Equity in Procurement. They have increased their spending in veterans-owned business in 2017. They have procured services and products from 123 certified veteran-owned businesses. And this is up 275% from the prior year. And that represents about $6.8 million that have now gone to veteran-identified companies. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much for sharing that with the committee. Next, Mr. Finley, Jim Finley from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We'll talk about the state's veteran hiring program. Someday, maybe we'll have some IT equipment here that the only thing people have to do is come in and plug in. You know, it'll be working for everybody. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was waiting for them to set up. You mentioned Vietnam earlier, and I got a message earlier today that the mobile Vietnam wall will be in Sauk Center from August 23rd through August 26th at the Eagle Sealy Nest.
Okay.
Just thought I'd mention that.
And with that, too, I think it's June 21, 22, 23. It's going to be here at the Capitol. And I think on the 23rd of talking to Mr. Kaiser, Jerry Kaiser, I guess there's going to be a flyover too during that time frame. So there'll be speakers and whatnot. So it should be a, weather permitting, it should be a neat experience. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Jim Finley. I'm the Director of Veterans Employment Programs with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the invitation. I work with the Veterans Employment Program at DEED. I'm going to talk a little bit about the staff. But to start off with, I will tell you that in Minnesota, hiring veterans is not goodwill but good business. That's what we talk to corporations and employers about in Minnesota. I'm going to cover just a little bit of information on the grant and how we operate, some current reality, some special projects we have for underserved populations of veterans, a little bit about our career fair, and then a little bit of performance information at the end. Department of Labor has a very small organization within the Employment and Training Division called Veterans Employment and Training Service. They are the ones that administer a grant called the Jobs for Veterans State Grant. All states get a Jobs for Veterans State Grant, and also each state has a federal director. In Minnesota, that's Mr. David C. We have two kinds of staff on the program. We have disabled veterans outreach program specialists. Those are our case managers. Those are the folks that work shoulder to shoulder with service members that come into the workforce centers on everything from resume assistance and interviewing skills to getting them connected with employers that are looking to hire. We do in-depth assessments with them on their skills. We also put together an employability plan, employment development plan, so we've got a path to the goal. We also employ local veterans employment representatives. These are our business arm. These are our staff that work directly with businesses. They educate businesses on the value that veterans bring to a business. They also educate other partners in the workforce center on how to provide services to veterans. In addition, they conduct some job search workshops and help employers set up recruiting campaigns for veterans. About 2014, Department of Labor decided that the Jobs for Veterans State Grant program needed to spend our resources and our time on our brothers and sisters that need the help the most. These are veterans that have significant barriers to employment. These barriers include low-income veterans, veterans with no high school credential, ex-offenders, homeless veterans, and also disabled veterans. So when veterans come into a workforce center, they fill out a questionnaire that asks them about barriers, and if they answer one of those questions affirmatively, that veteran's referred to one of the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program specialists for intensive services and case management. Why these veterans? Veterans that have significant barriers to employment suffer not only longer terms of unemployment, but they seem to not hold jobs as long. They struggle with job search due to their barriers, and the Jobs for Veterans State Grant's focus is on veterans with significant barriers to employment. A little bit on some projects that we've got going. Women veterans, Native American veterans, and ex-offenders, or veterans that have been involved with the criminal justice system, all are underserved populations. Their unemployment rates are higher, so we decided that would be a good place for us to focus as we were looking for special attention to certain populations. The Women Veterans Initiative we've had going for a couple of years. Average wage at placement is over $18 an hour for these women veterans that are working with our program. Native American veterans, again, has the highest rate of unemployment in the state, and the highest rate in the state is up in northern Minnesota. So that's where we have our veterans employment rep stationed. There again, he's worked with about 74 Native Americans. Wage at placement up there is an average of over $19 an hour. And ex-offenders, we're getting them jobs at a rate of over $15 an hour, which is significant. Beyond the yellow ribbon, Deed's been involved.
Representative O'Neill, did you have a question?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, to this point. I'm interested in the ex-offender. I also serve on civil law and public safety. And I actually was the person that expanded all the specialty courts across the entire state, including Veterans Court. So when you say ex-offenders, do you mean felony level or below felony level? And if it's felony level, I understand some of those barriers for both housing and employment. And if so, what are you doing to overcome that? Are you helping them go through an expungement process, or what exactly are you doing to kind of help them get their lives back?
Mr. Eggman,
Representative Dennis. Mr. Chair. We've actually got a special staff person assigned to this. He's a former police officer, so he knows that landscape. He knows that territory. Again, our goal is to provide intensive services, so that can be a lot of different things. We work very closely with those veterans one-on-one on how to answer difficult interview questions. We talk to them about the impact of their criminal record and how that might affect certain jobs that they apply for. We're also involved with the veterans courts in Minnesota, too. In fact, we sit on steering committees in Ramsey County and in Hennepin County. So they're a group that we focus on because they not only experience a large percentage of unemployment, but also they're facing very specific challenges as they look for work. That's why we went and hired the person that we did, because he's had some experience with that population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me how many of them are felons and how many of them don't have that category? Because when you have a felony, it prohibits you from a lot of work. I mean, there's very little that you can actually do once you have a felony. There's some, but it also excludes you from a lot of housing. So can you just help me understand, are these misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony level? When you say ex-offenders, and are you actually helping them, if they're felons, to go through the expungement process so they can get their lives back if they've gotten back on track? And, you know, between 85% and maybe even 90% of those coming through our entire court system have got a chemical dependency of some type. That's sort of the center of what their issues are. So are you helping them also with recovery?
Mr. Finley.
Thank you. Again, we do. Expungement, we've got resources that we can refer them to for that kind of work. We're not involved in that specific process ourselves. We are really very focused on the employment piece and the challenges that they're going to encounter. We do have several veterans with felonies on this program. In fact, again, we sit on that steering committee, so as they go through this process of actually reviewing each veteran and what their issues are and what their challenges are, we've got somebody at the table that's talking about the resources that we have and options that they may have as far as work. We've been able, and I can't say for sure because I don't have this information in front of me, but we've been pretty successful with this group of veterans. They're very motivated. In fact, it's very interesting in those courtrooms as veterans come up before a judge to see them stand at attention in front of that judge. That's their military coming out of them. There's been talk in Minnesota about developing areas or pods where within the correctional facilities where there would just be veterans, so they can call back that experience they had when they're in the military. All these folks, regardless of what they did, all these veterans in the military, they were successful. And so the idea behind some of those programs is to get them back to those days when they were successful and call on some of those resources that helped make them successful.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yellow Ribbon in Minnesota, Deed got involved with this in 2007. There were originally 8 partners. One of the requirements was that partners had statewide reach because we were doing demobilizations and reintegration events across the state. The focus was veterans. The reason I mention this is because in the early days, there was talk from different agencies and different folks about who's going to get credit for what, whose territory is this. We had a very charismatic Baptist preacher from the National Guard that was part of the early group that made it very clear to all of us that none of that mattered. What mattered was his veterans. And Adjutant General Shelleteau and then Senator Mark Dayton were two of the people that were behind this yellow ribbon effort in Minnesota in the early days. And General Shelleteau made a commitment that as a Vietnam veteran, his service members, his troops, were not going to come back to Minnesota the same way Vietnam-era veterans did. So the focus very early was veterans, and those are the rules that we played by. We would settle territories and the other things at another time. Deed does a Veterans Career Fair every year. We've been doing it since 2006. This all started with a direction from Department of Labor that required all states to provide a Veterans Career Fair within 15 days of Veterans Day. Well, the first year we found out that's also known as deer hunting season in Minnesota, so we did struggle. The dates have been changed over the years until now. This happens in July, which, as the commissioner mentioned before, Higher Veteran Month in Minnesota. The first year we attracted 68 employers and about 400 veterans. Our largest year for employers was 2016, where we had 242 employers, and again, that's because of the exceedingly low unemployment rate in Minnesota. Everybody's looking to hire somebody. The largest veteran turnout was in 2012 when the Brigade Combat Team returned from Kuwait. And that year there were about 1,500 veterans, including about 500 from the Brigade Combat Team. Demobilization and reintegration events. It's interesting because Minnesota is the only state that I know of that actually sends a demobilization team to a demobilization point. In other words, when National Guard troops come back from deployment, they come back to a stateside, usually Army base. Fort Bliss in Texas, Fort Dixon, New Jersey. Minnesota sends a team out there of service providers and resource people, again, because we want to make sure they get connected with the right resources and the right agencies and staff to help them through this reintegration process. Everybody who's ever worn the uniform goes through a reintegration process when they get back home. For some it's more difficult than others, but everybody experiences this, and we were trying to make this, General Shelleteau was trying to make this as smooth as possible for troops. I should point out, too, the last statement on that. Finding a job solves a lot of problems. Besides just meeting the mortgage and all the rest of the things, veterans need something to do. They need a mission. And so for them to be able to come back and find a job where they feel like they're making a contribution is a huge piece of their mental health. They've got another mission. They've got something to do. I've been doing this for a long time. That has never changed with veterans. It's always been about the mission. It's not about the pay or the title. It's about who am I going to serve and what am I going to be doing. What's the mission? Some quick facts from our performance department, just about the kind of veterans that we serve. 30% or 38% have a disability, which is a barrier to employment. 14% are women, 25% are from communities of color, 15% are ex-offenders. So we do a lot of outreach. We spend a lot of time getting into the veterans community and trying to identify those, again, that have significant barriers to employment. Last year, we served twice as many veterans who are women than are in the population. So 14% of the people we served were women. About 6.4% in the population are women in the military. About three times as many veterans from communities of color. Over half of the unemployed veterans across Minnesota are enrolled in a workforce program, typically through the workforce systems. And 1,415 veterans received track services. So in other words, they were enrolled in our system, we were providing services to them, and we were tracking those services and those outcomes. Is anyone better off? Finally, 81% of the veterans receiving intensive case services entered successfully or exited successfully. They were either employed, they entered training, or they were self-employed. Again, average wage at exit was over $18 an hour.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I know you mentioned at that time General Shelato was very involved in the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program, but I know that at that same time, I know Governor Pawlenty and First Lady Mary had a big role in establishing that across the state. And there's many businesses and cities and communities that are now becoming beyond the Yellow Ribbon programs.
Right,
so
right.
Across the state. So
well, we're very excited about the Yellow Ribbon effort. In fact, MMB indeed are in discussions right now to have an all veterans career fair. So we do a big career fair with private businesses. This would focus on state agencies and departments to attract veterans to state employment.
Governor Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm connecting up a little bit. We heard a bill on the Education Committee talking about seniors graduating from high school and going into the service. So when someone then becomes a veteran and is leaving the service, when they just have that high school degree, are they able to match up skills that they've acquired through their service, to these new job careers? And as we're talking about all these job shortages that we have right now, so you're kind of in a position to see that flow back into the workforce. Sure. And can you give me also some insight as someone that's also concerned with K-12 education and what happens after that?
Mr. Finley.
Thank you. We do. In fact, a few years ago, Minnesota was selected to participate in a National Governors Association Policy Academy to look at licensure and certification for veterans based on their training in the military. And the example I use the most is a combat medic comes back with a lot of very specific skills. They've had some very specific training. And yet when they come back, they're not really eligible to do much except take a test for a certified nursing assistant and get a job doing that. The goal on this was actually twofold: to shorten the amount of time that veterans spend in class. So in other words, to give them some credit for the training that they received in the military and to shorten the length of time that they collected unemployment insurance. So Minnesota selected peace officers and paramedics and LPNs. And the first class, I believe, was just launched at in Duluth at the community college up there for LPNs. And they believe that they're going to cut off 25% to 30% of the seat time in class because they're going to be giving credit to these service members and the training that they had in the military. And so that gets them out onto the job that much quicker. We've also looked at law enforcement. We worked with a group from the State Patrol, and we talked to them about the skills that are required and what kind of credit we could provide for people going into law enforcement. So they've actually made a couple of changes in the law. I don't want to get into the minutia, but you used to need a certain amount of experience as a police officer that was consecutive time, and now it's cumulative time. And so these service members who go off on drill for a weekend at a time and 2 weeks in the summer are able to add that time up, and when they hit that particular point in time, they're eligible for licensure through the Pulse Board. So there are some efforts being made to that. People that come out of military with high school credentials only, I believe, are still being hired at a greater rate because businesses understand some of the soft skills that these folks learn in the military. And things beyond teamwork and leadership, which are the obvious ones, but the ability to work under pressure and finish a job and work a job till it's done are sometimes rare qualities. And so they like to hire veterans because they bring that to the job.
And, you know, for some information for the committee here, if you, I'm carrying a bill, House File 2788, that allows the
the recruiters from the different branches better access to our schools. And we've also added the trades to that, too, so that gives schools, students, a better broad, you know, if the schools are hosting college fairs, also include the different military branches, also the trades, to be there to answer questions that students might have. And I think, Representative Frankie, you're carrying a Minnesota GI Bill apprenticeship training program. So that those are some things that we should be looking for, because, you know, students come out right out of high school, as Representative Pryor, you talking about that. That's very important that they are exposed to these different opportunities out there, because maybe a four-year school is not for everybody, maybe a trade school or apprenticeship with some of the trades. And then the military has the program from helmets to hard hats, right at a lot of businesses are looking at. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. And I think the earlier students can see those opportunities, the better. So, but thank you, Mr. Finley, for sharing that information for us. And the last two presentations are groups that we've heard from last year, and the legislature provided some funding to them for their programs, and with an update of where we'd like to, I invited them here for an update of where they're at with their projects and how the money is being spent. So first we'll take, we have a look of Mr. Brock Hunter, president of the Veterans Defense Project. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
One moment. Okay.
Looks like you've done that before.
Once or twice. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm the president of the Veterans Defense Project. I am a former Army Recon Scout and now an attorney in private practice, devoting a significant percentage of my practice to defending veterans in the criminal courts, both here in the Minnesota State Courts as well as veterans charged with federal offenses across the country. I've worked for many years with veterans in the criminal courts, and in the last decade have done a lot of out-of-court advocacy and education on behalf of veterans in the criminal justice system. In the process of that, we founded the Veterans Defense Project, a Minnesota-based nonprofit with a national scope mission to educate and advocate the criminal justice system to ensure we do a better job this time around with veterans coming into the criminal court system than we have with veterans in the past. This past year, the Minnesota legislature appropriated funding to the Veterans Defense Project, and I want to thank you, members of this committee, had a significant hand in doing so. The mission, as we've set out over the next 2 years, is to expand and improve the way Minnesota's criminal courts deal with troubled veterans by helping them understand the nature of combat trauma, its ties to criminal behavior, and how criminal charges can serve as an intervention opportunity to leverage troubled veterans into needed treatment and help them become assets rather than ongoing liabilities to the communities they once risked their lives to protect. When done right, a successful Veterans Court graduate emerges from their case in better shape than when they entered, at a significant lower risk to reoffend against their communities and able to move forward in life and fulfill their full potential. As we set out on this mission, we knew there was going to be some challenges. The first is increasing numbers of troubled veterans flowing into the Minnesota criminal courts. This is something that we have been observing for quite some time. We don't have exact numbers because, frankly, we're not counting them, which is something I think we should look into doing. But anecdotally, it's clear that both in Minnesota and across the country, troubled veterans are coming into our justice system in increasing numbers. And we believe that that trend is going to continue into the foreseeable future for reasons that I'll get into here in a moment. We also knew that there's a wide diversity of forms and philosophies in Minnesota's existing veterans courts. These are all grassroots endeavors, each of them are in the individual petri dish. And we knew that coming into this, if we're going to improve and expand courts across the state, we're going to have to address that diversity in forms. One issue we did not really fully expect was the declining buy-in from key stakeholder groups across the state, leading to declining numbers of veterans in some of Minnesota's existing veterans courts. We'll get into that more significantly as the presentation goes on. First of all, I want to address the increasing numbers of veterans coming into our courts and why we're seeing this and why we're confident that this trend will continue for the foreseeable future. Simply, the fact of the matter is that history tells us this is so. When we look back at our last major war, Vietnam, of the government statistics, 3 million Americans served in Vietnam and 1 to 1.5 million suffered long-term psychological issues related to their service. Half of the veterans being treated by the VA by the mid-1980s for post-traumatic stress had some criminal justice contact, half of them. And of course, Vietnam was a very unpopular war with the American public, and our veterans came home and were often demonized and discarded, especially when they acted out in against their communities in ways that brought them into the criminal courts. Department of Justice studies show that Vietnam veterans were treated more harshly on average in the American criminal justice system than civilians committing the same crimes during that period. I think we were afraid of these folks. We didn't know how to treat them then, and we didn't know what else to do but put them in cages and hope that it would somehow deter future bad behavior. Unfortunately, those lock-em-up policies continue to haunt us to this day in many ways. According to government and other studies, hundreds of thousands of Vietnam-era veterans remain chronically incarcerated, homeless, and addicted across our country. The echoes of these policies continue to reverberate. And the suicide rate among Vietnam veterans is a highly controversial topic. We'll never know how many veterans of the Vietnam War took their lives after that war, but most experts that I respect agree that at least as many died by their own hand after the war as died in it, around 60,000. And many Vietnam veterans groups argue that the numbers are actually far higher. When you include drug overdoses and other self-destructive behavior, the numbers start to climb up to 150,000. Contrast that to our current generation of veterans. The National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine published a study in 2012 that at that point found that 2.6 million Americans had served in Iraq or Afghanistan. That number is now well north of 3 million. And of that 2.6 million, the National Academy found that up to 20% or 500,000 are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They also acknowledge, though, that this number is almost certainly far below the reality because of the delayed onset of symptoms among those suffering these invisible injuries, as well as the reluctance to report these injuries by those who suffer from them. The numbers are almost certainly far higher. And the suicide today rate today is on pace to eclipse that of previous generations. The active duty services currently log an average of one suicide per day. We're losing more to suicide than we are to combat. And the VA estimates an average of 20 veterans commit suicide each day in America. That number is recently down from 22 a day, so we are doing some things right, and those results are showing. But we're losing far too many. And I would also note that these numbers include veterans of the Vietnam era who unfortunately are still taking their own lives, still struggling with their demons from the war 40 plus years ago. Every expert that works in the area of combat trauma that I know across this country is concerned and I would say even convinced that the rates of post-traumatic stress in this current generation of veterans are going to outpace those of any previous generation before them. And the reason for that is the multiple deployments that we're doing in these current conflicts. In Vietnam and other wars, we had a draft, and with that draft, we spread the burden of fighting over many more shoulders. An average Vietnam veteran served one 12-month tour in combat, and their obligation was up. The vast majority served just one tour. Contrast that to today, where we have a much smaller, all-voluntary military force, and we are recycling them over and over and over again in order to sustain what have now become the longest wars in our country's history. Today, finding veterans of the Iraq and Afghan War who served two or three combat deployments is commonplace. And within the ground combat forces, the Army and the Marine Corps, we're seeing even more deployments. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 full-year-long deployments reported among some of our troops by the Department of Defense.
Mr. Hunter, we're going to have to just tighten it up a little bit because we have one more group coming.
I'm going to move through this all very quickly. Okay. Our Special Operations Forces, who fought at the very tip of this spear during these conflicts, have deployed even more times. Marko Milosevic, who testified before your committee this last year, served 12 combat deployments with the Army's Ranger Regiment and the Joint Special Operations Command. Mm-hmm. And he's quick to point out that he's nothing special. He has buddies still serving that are on their 22nd and 23rd deployments with special operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and elsewhere. The rates of PTSD, everyone agrees, climb with each additional combat deployment, and that's why these multiple deployments are really a significant cause of concern. A senior Army general was quoted in the American Conservative just this past month saying, "We're killing our kids, we're breaking the Army," and he talks extensively about the unprecedented strain that we're putting on our armed forces today and that the cracks are starting to show. How does combat trauma lead to criminal behavior? It's pretty straightforward and simple. Many of these folks are coming home without being diagnosed or treated. They're self-medicating with alcohol or drugs and falling into self-destructive, reckless, and sometimes violent behavior. Often it's their military training and conditioning itself that leads to react violently in threatening or adversarial situations. And sometimes we have veterans suffering dissociative episodes or flashbacks, which are reliving the combat experience as if it's happening in the moment. Again, I'm going to move through this. A lot of this is in your materials, and I want to get on to our work. But suffice it to say that we have seen veteran-committed crime waves well now documented by scholars following every major conflict that our country has ever fought. And current studies by the Army clearly tie combat trauma to violent behavior. The good news is that PTSD treatments are improving. Today, the VA has greatly expanded its treatment capacity, and there are very effective exposure therapies that are now available to veterans suffering combat trauma. The catch is that these therapies are themselves traumatic, at least in their initial stages, as we rip off the scab off of psychological wounds and drain out the toxins. Veterans who voluntarily come into these programs frequently quit before they start to see the real benefits. And we also have something in our office we call Superman syndrome. This is just the byproduct of the intense training and conditioning that many of our forces go under that leads them to believe that they can and should be able to handle these problems on their own. I'll talk now about what we're finding here in Minnesota. We're seeing a wide diversity of treatment veteran support programs across the state. Some veteran supports follow the national model, and every veteran coming through the program is given an opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction, even in felony cases. We heard from Mr. Finley about the impairment on a veteran's ability to get a job that comes with a felony conviction or any other kind of conviction. Yet some of our courts are convicting every veteran that comes through the court with their crime, with their felony. It's a great deal of diversity there. Sorry, my mouth is dry now.
Mr. We need to start wrapping it up because I want to at least give the next group some time to
understand
do the presentation.
We also are seeing declining buy-in from our stakeholders across the state. The public defender, I apologize, I drank too much coffee. In existing courts across the state, there seems to have been some that have lost sight of what veterans courts are supposed to be about. Those that were giving opportunities to veterans to avoid their criminal conviction in some cases are no longer doing so. And as I said, veterans are beginning to be convicted or are increasingly being convicted of these crimes in cases where they did not used to be. And the public defenders have pulled out of the veterans courts across Minnesota because of this ongoing issue. So in coming into this mission, This first part of the solution that we've identified that we need to follow is to get the stakeholder groups back together, to get everyone around the table. The Veterans Court Working Group that we have formed consists of Judge Renee Werke from the Court of Appeals, who's present here with us today, judges from the Hennepin, Ramsey, and Anoka Veterans Courts, county attorneys John Choi and Pete Orpett from the Ramsey and Washington counties, Bill Ward, the state defender, representative from the VA, David Holowinski, and Ben Johnson from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We have been meeting on a monthly basis to get consensus around how these courts should work before we start pushing out this model across the state. We're hoping that this consensus-building effort will lead to a proposed legislation for the legislature this coming session so that we can take this work and put it into law and not have to reinvent the wheel again in 5 years.
Okay. Mr. Hunter, did you send the slide presentation to us?
I
could get that out to the committee because we do have to wrap it up now.
I understand, so, Mr. Okay. Chair. I thank you for the opportunity to present to you, and I'm happy to come back at another time to give you additional information as this process unfolds. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. You too, Markle.
Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you. Finally, we have Mr. Blake Huffman, CEO of Veterans Journey Home. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd also like to say hello to my own representative, Representative Rebecca Finn. So, pleasure to be here. Blake Huffman, I am here today as the, as Chair Detmer said, the Executive Director of Journey Home Minnesota. My other role in life is I am a County Commissioner in Ramsey County when I'm not doing this role. I am the perfect person to rent and up your day of testifying because I'll be quick. And I'll get you out of here. Journey Home is a simple organization that provides affordable housing to veterans, among other populations, but specifically to veterans. We focus on three things: affordable housing, safe neighborhoods, served by great schools. We think those three as a combination are really important to establish housing that makes sense for veterans and their families. We have built approximately 45 houses as to date, and as we sit here today, we have houses being built or in pre-development in Shoreview, North Oaks, Roseville, Arden Hills, Lindstrom, and then all the way up in Duluth and Grand Marais, Minnesota. So we have homes all over the state, although we're largely north suburban based. I should have started out by saying thank you, first of all, for last year, for hearing us speak last year, and thank you for getting that bill passed that granted us $350,000 over the course of 2 years, or $700,000 in total. The good news is that we are told we have that money. The interesting news, or the awkward news, is we haven't received it yet. We're told from the MDVA that there's a little two technicalities going on. One is the bill is addressed to Journey Home Minnesota, which is a brand of Journey Home Minnesota. Veterans Journey Home versus Journey Home Minnesota. We're told that the Senator Bruce Anderson, his office is trying to fix that. And the other issue that has slowed the money coming to us is confusion over home ownership versus rental housing. This is for rental housing. This money would be used, as we talked about last year, this money would be used for veterans, for us to build homes that veterans would rent. We'd keep that housing rental for the length of up to 20 years, which I think is what the committee had requested last year. Once those two issues are resolved, we will continue to move forward. But it's important to say, Representative Detmer, I wanted you to know that those homes I mentioned, we're building 14 homes as we speak. We're not slowing down because we don't have the money from the state. We'll find the money from other sources, from private funds as well as other sources. And we'll continue to do what we're doing because we believe there's nothing more important than fulfilling our mission, and that is providing our nation's heroes quality and affordable housing.
Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank
Mr. Huffman, I guess, in this role, not Commissioner Huffman. And just wanted to kind of emphasize something you noted at the beginning. You know, we talk about affordable housing a lot, and one of the nice things about these projects is that we have really good school districts up in the North Metro, and so families are able to be in these school districts where they would want to be, and now they can afford to be there. So it's kind of a nice benefit of the location of some of these homes.
I could agree with you more.
Yes, Representative.
I guess so. Are we okay, or is this something we need to carry forward into 2018 to make sure you get the appropriation?
You know, I'm not
Mr. Huffman.
I think you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure of that, to be honest. Senator Smith, I'm sorry, Senator Anderson. I'll get that right. Said he was working on it. I'm not familiar with the process as well as I should be, perhaps.
Well, Mr. Huffman, I'm sure you know. You have to be working with MDDA.
Yes.
You know, they have the funds, and you have to meet their requirements.
Yes.
And ensure that you'll be working with them closely.
Yes.
To work out the differences.
Yep.
There. So.
And we'll continue to do so.
Let us know.
Okay. Any other questions? And Mr. Mr. Hunter, would you? I forgot to ask you the funds that we provided you last time. How are those funds helping you,
Mr. Chair? That was the tail end of my presentation.
Okay.
We have put together a working group made up of the major stakeholders across the state, and have been meeting monthly, putting together a consensus that we hope to have relatively soon, and then we are scheduling trainings throughout the state to all of the major stakeholder groups, including the judges, the prosecutors, the public defenders, probation, and others, as well as district-wide training programs across the state, where we will help establish and stand up rural district-wide veterans court programs. We have 12 veterans courts out of 87 counties in the state, so most counties are not currently served, and our goal here at the end of this two-year grant period is to have some form of a veterans court protocol set up in every jurisdiction, which, if successful, will make us the first state in the country.
Mr. Hunter, what was the amount last year?
$500,000. Chair.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. And members, we're going to be, after the Easter break, we'll be meeting, I think, on that April 9th. And that could be our last meeting, because we've done all the work that we need to do as a division. And yes, Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was one meeting that was canceled because of snow, and that was to review the different proposals for beds. Is that my memory
that
serves me?
That could be what our meeting is going to be on the 9th.
Okay.
So
well,
we have
look forward to it.
We have to work that out with the Senate. And so forth. So, but that's what we're going to be doing. And I'd like to wish everybody the best few days that we get off during the Easter break. And with that, every day in Minnesota is a Veterans Day. We are adjourned.